Ladies and gentlemen, citizens of the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, get ready.
Please give it up.
This is Rihanna.
It's Rihanna.
Rihanna Patrick, ABC Local Radio.
I'm sure you remember your first experience of a video game. I had to think back about what my first game was that I ever played, and I'm pretty sure it was Pac-Man. And then somehow one Christmas I ended up with a handheld game that came complete with a joystick embedded kind of in it, and it was a little bit of a rip-off of the version of the real thing, I think. But the history of electronic games might go further back than you might think. And someone who might know a little bit about that history of electronic games is Dan Golding, who's a lecturer in media at Swinburne University, is also the author of Game Changers, and he did a radio series on the history of electronic games for RN. Good evening, Dan.
Hi, Rihanna.
And Stefan Antichik is the owner of the Nostalgia Box in Perth, and it's Australia's first video game console museum. Good evening to you, Stefan.
Good evening.
Now, Dan, I thought I'd start with you in terms of, I know that your series on electronic games, you went all the way back. What is, I suppose, the condensed version of that electronic game history? Because it goes further back than some of us might actually think.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you were to ask, sort of anybody on the street, or I mean, if they had any idea at all, they might point to something like Pong as the birth of video games. And that's certainly true as far as it's commercially concerned. But people sort of thought about playing games with computers dating back to really the early pioneering experiments with computing in the 1940s and the search for artificial intelligence that really informed the Cold War as well. So really looking back quite far back into the history.
Stefan, how long have you been playing electronic games, and have you moved on from that first game that you played back in the day to continuing to do gaming now?
I've played since I was about four when I first got my console, and I still play it. Luckily for me, it was one of the most iconic games ever, Super Mario Brothers, and it's kept its age. It hasn't gotten older at all. I mean, it's still fun.
Dan, did some of these early games, do they follow the same premise? I mean, you mentioned Pong there, which pretty much is, if you've never played it, you've got two bars that hit a square ball. It's quite basic. It can be, depending if you're the parent in the room, maybe quite annoying as well. But it's one of those games that, if you've been playing games that are out today, you'd be thinking, what is going on? But did most of them have that same thing where they were either player interaction or whether you were actually shooting something else?
Yeah, I mean, so Pong is interesting because it was designed for a social setting. It was designed to be played in bars and pubs, and I suppose then the arcade followed that. And so it was very much about, creating a situation between two people or more, really, in a room. Whereas as games, I suppose, expanded, it became more about, the player and the computer and their own environment and these sort of more, epic single player or sort of narrative experiences that we have today. Games have really changed and ebbed and flowed depending on their circumstances. And definitely there are still games today that are about that social experience too.
Stefan, what was it about Super Mario Brothers that got you hooked to the point that you still play it today?
Yeah, I still play it today. I think that particular game was just every little aspect of its design from the very first level, from the very first enemy or trooper you have to jump over. It's just such a well-designed game, and the difficulty scales so appropriately. It's still a fantastic game.
Dan, were these early games, were they actually aimed and marketed to children?
Well, it depends how far back you're going to go. I mean, as I said before, something like Pong was really found in bars and those sorts of environments. I mean, it was set up and left in a bar called Andy Capp's Tavern in America. They were called back a few days later thinking that it was broken. And it turned out that it just couldn't accept any more coins because it was simply so popular. It was overflowing. But then beyond that, I suppose you did get, particularly with the Super Marios that Stefan is talking about there, there, that sort of an era sort of more consciously turned towards kids as a primary market, even though actually adults have always played video games. And it's not necessarily always been a kids thing at all, but certainly in that period, in sort of the late 70s, early 1980s, games started to be marketed more consciously at kids, definitely.
So we've been talking about Pong, Dan and Stefan, and someone who knows a little bit more about Pong, Dick Smith, from obviously Dick Smith Electronics. Now, Dick, you were responsible for bringing in the first electronic Pong games.
Well, yes, not actually the Atari one, which was the famous one, but when I owned Dick Smith Electronics, and admittedly this is, what, over 30 years ago, I was at Gore Hill, and one day a little Hong Kong bloke, a Chinaman from Hong Kong, sent me this Bits and Pieces, which was sort of a very cheap Pong game playing table tennis in effect. And it was so incredible at the time that I rang up, I think it was either Channel 10 or Channel 9, and they came to my home and put it on the television news. Imagine that, because this was sort of a kit you could use at home yourself, build it up yourself, and then play on the TV set a Pong game.
Dick, what were those early days like in Australia? I mean, do you remember when one of the first arcade games started to be played in Australia? Were you, you know, amongst all of that, being, you know, obviously, you know, involved in electronics?
Yeah, look, I was, but I was more of a ham radio operator and hobbyist, and I never was a great player of arcade games, except I loved the original ones, which were mainly what we called electromechanical, because as a 14-year-old, now I was born in 1944, so that would have been, what, 58 or something? I don't know, I'm not very good at figures. I built a noughts and crosses computer out of telephone parts, things called uniselectors and relays, because before we had, when I was young, there was no such thing as a transistor. It was vacuum tubes or valves. And basically everything you built was electromechanical, and those original arcade games were electromechanical.
So, Dick, what did you ever have your first electronic game experience apart from Pong and trying that out? Or did you just build your own?
Believe it or not, my first one was this crazy Chinaman who sent me. No one could believe, because Atari designed, and it was sort of the ultimate. You look at a basic Pong game today and you just think, how basic, how pathetic. But in those days, it was about 1971, 72. It was just mind-boggling. And then when one gets sent to us from this little inventor in China, and he'd obviously pinched the Atari ideas or patent, and we wondered, if we sell this thing, will we be taken on by Atari? But we never were. I think we were so tiny in the sales. But it allowed hobbyists and enthusiasts, I think for about $30, to build up their own Pong game and play it on a TV set.
That's fantastic. Thank you for calling in, Dick.
It's a pleasure. Great listening to you.
Dick Smith there, talking about one of the sort of the first electronic Pong games that he brought into Australia. Fascinating listening to that. I mean, Stefan, when you look at the games in your own collection, and maybe some of those games at the Nostalgia Box in Perth, what are the games that you have in your collection at the moment?
Well, we basically have two parts. The museum has about 100 consoles on display with a bit of information about them, starting from the first commercially sold on the Magnavox Odyssey. We do have that Pong machine that, you know, it was made famous, the Atari 2600, through to the later stuff. And we actually have, you have an opportunity to play the games, including a classic Sears Pong. And despite the fact that it's, as Dick pointed out, very basic, the nature of it, that you're playing against someone and it has a certain level of skill required, it, you know, gets very competitive, and people, you know, end up more engaged with Pong itself rather than a more advanced console.
Dan, when we look at how far we've come, and when we start going from sort of those arcade games into the consoles, what kind of development do we see there?
Oh, well, all sorts of things. I mean, I think it starts to go past what I think Dick and Stefan have been talking about, which is that kind of spectacle of just seeing something move on the screen that you're controlling. I think there's a fundamental kind of appeal of that was almost magical in the 1970s in particular. And you start to go past that to things like colour. Of course, the original Pong machine is in black and white. So as you start to get, you know, the more advanced consoles in the 1980s, you get, you know, greater graphical fidelity, more complicated controls, more complicated games. Games start to sort of form their own language that, you know, people start to almost get literate, if you want to use that word, in the different styles and forms of video games. And so they become much more sophisticated than sort of, you know, the instructions for Pong was, what was it, avoid missing ball for high score, you know, where the entire appeal of the game can be summed up in one sentence. Things start to get much more complicated as you go on there.
I think it's so interesting to see those earlier games, and I'm sure you agree with me, Dan and Stefan, that we have come a long way, and I think there's still so much more that we're going to see in our lifetimes. If you have just joined me here on ABC Local Radio, I'm Rhianna Patrick, and we are talking about electronic games tonight, a little bit about the history, and also I'm wanting to know from you, sort of, you know, what was the first electronic game that you ever played, that you remember, 1300 800 222, if you want to share that with Dan, Stefan and myself tonight. That's 1300 800 222, or you can tweet in using the ABC RE hashtag, which is just ABC RHI. But yeah, what was that first game? Do you remember that first experience that you had? Heather in Victoria, what was the experience that you had?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, Heath. Sorry, Heath. I just called you Heather. I've just completely changed your gender tonight.
Funny. My first experience was actually, now that you're talking about Pong, was actually Space Invaders at a friend's house.
Oh, wow.
But at home, we had a 386 computer. It was our first computer, and I played a game called F117A.
And what was the game exactly? What did you have to achieve, and what did you have to do?
I think it was the first ever stealth bomber, and it was declassified a couple of years before my 11th birthday. And I believe I got that for the Christmas before my 11th birthday. I got this game that I installed on. What was it? The old floppy disk. I can't remember the format size, but it's, most people wouldn't remember unless they're really old. It's a really floppy.
The really big ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was about 12 disks. So.
Really? So you had to put those in at different stages when it would prompt you?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
And it was all on DOS, so you had to sort of set up a menu for it and everything.
Oh. Heath, that just sounds like such a... It used to be such an effort, didn't it? Getting your games loaded.
Oh, the kids these days have no idea.
So true. Like, I remember playing the Commodore 64 and my next-door neighbours had just got it, and I was like, I didn't know what it was. And they're like, yeah, you just put this in. Now we've got to go outside and play for a couple of hours while it loads.
Yeah, it was a 12-stage process, I believe.
Oh, Heath, you must. And do you still play games today? Are you still a gamer?
Very much so, yeah. It's addictive.
So once you're in there, you kind of just continue on.
The games these days are so achievement-based, and it feels like you can spend 3 hours and achieve a lot, but you're not really.
So do you think that's the big difference between playing games back in the day to playing games now?
Oh, there's a lot of differences, really. That's one of them, sure.
Heath, thank you so much for your call.
No worries. Thank you for talking to me.
Heath in Victoria there sharing that his first computer game that he ever had was the F117A, which he played on a 386 computer. Dan and Stefan, you familiar with the 386 computer or the F117A?
I think the interesting thing that probably some of your listeners, and I mean maybe Heath, would remember as well, is that even before discs, how games were often distributed for computers like the Commodore and things like that as well, the microcomputers that were really popular in Australia in the 70s and 80s, is actually through magazines, in that the code was printed in magazines. You'd go to the store, you'd buy your video games magazine, and then you'd go through and you'd type in the code from the print magazine manually, line by line yourself, and then, you know, compile it and then run the game. And that would be how the game would be distributed, because, you know, even before floppy disks and things like that, you actually, you know, that was the way that you were able to load games into your computer. So that sort of thing as well is absolutely fantastic. And I was reminded of that when Heath was talking about, you know, going outside to play while the, you know, 5.5-inch floppy disks load. It's really quite different to today.
Stefan, do you remember that first game that took forever to load that you played?
That's going back quite a while. So some games, just especially the ones you had to reset quite a bit, and you had to go through the whole loading process again because something bugged out or the game wasn't released. Finished. You know, these days you have the whole patching process, but back in those days, if a game wasn't finished, you just have to deal with it. If there was a bug, you have to deal with it yourself.
Did you ever, Stefan, get to a kill screen?
Yeah, many times.
Oh,
many times.
What about you, Dan? Were you ever, like, skilled enough to get to a kill screen?
Unfortunately, no. No, my age also means that those sorts of things, the kill screens are sort of more a myth that I read about than something I experienced firsthand. Yeah.
Oh, Dan. Well, Simon, in Western Australia, you've got an Atari game that you want to mention.
Back in the day, it was a fair while ago, but Tank. I mean, the Atari came out with compilation with cartridges that had multiple games on them, and I think Tank was my favourite. Just very basic, roll around the screen and your bullets kind of bounce off the walls, and it was definitely. And the other memory I have is sending away for cassettes that came through the mail and putting them into I think it was an I can't remember the name of the computer, but so you'd sit there and the cassette would have to load, and there was things like Roland in the Caves and Lord of the Rings, and quite a few others.
Stefan, do you remember Tank on Atari?
No, I never played a Tank on Atari, but I did play Tank on NES, which may have been a remake of that. But with Atari, there were so many games released that it's impossible to, I think there's 500 to 600 games, just licensed games. And then on top of that, you had so many third-party homebrews, pirate games released. It's just impossible to keep a complete library of the Atari games.
And Simon, did you go on to play games after this, you know, when, you know, the home consoles, and then, you know, do you play games on your iPhone now, and do you have other gaming consoles?
I went through the PlayStations. From PlayStation 1. I mean, I guess, Amiga 500 back in the day, a lot of games came out on those sort of budget computers through the 80s. Onto through the PlayStations, I guess.
And have you kept any of these games, Simon?
I've got the Atari around somewhere, but not really. They kind of all got used until they broke.
that's pretty much it. Or if you have siblings, Simon, as I did, you had to hide everything.
Oh, absolutely.
Simon, thank you so much for your call.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
Simon in Western Australia, bringing a bit of Tank on Atari to the conversation tonight. Tony in New South Wales. You got a bit of a trick about how you get more credits, or how you used to get more credits, I should say, Tony.
In the mid to late 60s, when I was going to school, my father was a safety officer, so my school shoes were steel cap shoes.
Yeah?
And, the boys used to lift the penny up onto my caps, so the ball didn't go down the hole. And you'd get about 20 games up, then lift the penny back down gently, not to tilt it, and you'd have 23 games. Like, it was 5 cents a game, you know?
Yeah.
So you just put 5 cents in, get 20 games up, and lift it back down off my shoes, and have a proper game. There.
Oh, Tony. If there's a system, someone will find a way to get around it, won't they?
Yeah, I don't know anything about electronic games or anything, but I did know how to fix a penny.
I love it. Tony, yeah, thank you for your call.
All right.
Tony in New South Wales there with a bit of what he used to do for a pinball machine if he wanted to get a few added credits. I'm Rhianna Patrick, and if you have joined me here on ABC Local Radio, we're talking all about electronic games tonight. Dan Golding from Swinburne University is one of my guests. He's also the author of Game Changers. And Stefan Antichik is the co-owner of Nostalgia Box in Perth in Western Australia, which is Australia's first video game console museum. Stefan, on that, thinking about Tony, but also about how looking after your games and how looking after your consoles, particularly if you have a museum, how have you managed to amass the number of consoles that you have in your museum if, like our previous caller was talking about, that they, you know, they end up either broken by your siblings or you just tend to get rid of them to get the latest version?
It's difficult. I mean, most people, when they get a new console, they usually get rid of the old one. So to get our collection, we had to literally scour the globe. And a lot of consoles were never released in Australia in the first place. So we had to buy from private collectors. I picked some up overseas. You never know as well. I mean, we've had people come in and donate their consoles. And, you know, they said, oh, it's been sitting in the shed for the last 15 years, but you clean it up a bit and hey, it works.
Stefan, is there a trick to looking after if you have an old game at home, particularly an old electronic game, of what you should do in terms of taking care of that and to keep it in its best condition?
To start with, don't blow on the cartridge. That's what a lot of people did back in the day, and it actually makes it worse. Just using a bit of alcohol on a swab just to clean out all the little bits and nooks and crannies. Often it's just dust that's causing the problem, but at the same time, I would advise caution because plugging in electronic equipment that could be 20 years old, maybe a bit of a fire hazard, so just be careful.
So definitely, if you haven't plugged it in for, a little while perhaps, Stefan, people should probably get it checked out properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your first game, the first electronic game that you remember playing? That's the question tonight, 1300 800 222. Stefan, Dan and myself would love to know what you used to play back in the day, or maybe if it's even not even that long ago. You've already, you've started, you might not know half the games that we're talking about tonight, but maybe you've got something else that you started on that you'd like to share with us. 1300 800 222 tonight. David in Victoria, you had a friend who was obsessed with Space Invaders.
Hi.
So tell me about this. Were you dragged along to watch him play Space Invaders?
A little bit, yeah.
So tell me about that experience. Did it get you hooked, or did you end up finding a different game?
No. So I'd watch my friend playing Space Invaders, and I sort of think, yeah, it's okay. But but this was back in the early days of video games, and the next phase that came along, there were a few arcade games. There was a game called Elevator, which was quite good fun. It was like this spy, which used to go up in an elevator into a building. That was highly entertaining. But I got to tell you about my friend.
Okay.
With the Space Invaders. He predicted back then, he said, and one day there will be games where it will be in three dimensions and you'll go into a room and you'll actually pick up an object and look at it and have to, right? So this friend of mine predicted this the three-dimensional games.
So he just happened to be able to tell you the future right then and there, and you Absolutely. Believe him now.
Well, yeah, I mean, I thought that was pretty amazing prediction.
And David, did you have a favourite when it came to an electronic game?
Well, back in those days, I'm talking, I think, about 1981 or something like that. So I don't know if that's something that you can remember or not, but...
Yeah, I was around then.
Were you?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, do you remember Elevator?
I don't remember Elevator as such. Yes. I do remember some of the other ones, yes. And yes. Tank I remember on Atari as well, because I have played that.
Tank. So my favourite game was a thing called Battle Zone, which was an arcade game, and it had a representation of three dimensions, but it was drawn in a sort of isometric three-dimensional form, like you would, like when I was growing up, I had to do tech drawing at school.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had like an infinity point and it was drawn to the horizon. So there'd be this black screen with green lines in perfect isometric perspective. And then you'd be driving across this kind of like flat landscape and these tanks would come out at you like in perfect isometric three-dimensional. It was drawn beautifully, and as the game progressed, the tanks would come faster and faster and you'd get like destroyed.
As it always did. It always sped up in the end, didn't it? David, thank you so much tonight for sharing your friend's story about playing Space Invaders, but your own of being roped in with him to be a part of that. Stefan, do you remember a bit of Battle Zone?
Yeah, I do. And it was drawn in lines. It was called vector graphics. So by designing the game using vector graphics, you could actually, I guess, fit a lot more into the game because it was a lot easier for the processors of the time to, process those graphics as opposed to full-on, more typical types of games.
Yeah.
The reason it got faster, you know, more games, more tanks would appear through time is that was just the nature of arcade games. They'll start you off a little bit slow, but, you know, it's all about turnover. It's all about how many coins you spend. And what we find these days is when kids come in and try those games that are from that arcade type of era, they always comment how difficult it is, and of course it's difficult. The more difficult it was, the more coins you had to spend.
Yeah, exactly. I'm Rhianna Patrick, and we're talking electronic gaming tonight with Dan Golding from Swinburne University and also Stefan Antichik, who you just heard there, who's the co-owner of the Nostalgia Box in Perth in Western Australia. Dan, we have been, we had a mention there of Space Invaders. What's the significance of Space Invaders?
It was one of these really formative games in the arcade era and really, really, you know, got people excited about playing games in the arcade. One of the things that I think sticks in people's memories is the way that, as your previous caller was talking about, it would speed up as you continued through the game. And myth has it, and maybe Stefan can clarify this, but myth has it that the reason that that game speeds up is because it would free up memory. The more aliens that you destroyed, the easier it became to run the game, and so the faster the game would run, and that sort of kickstarted this getting faster to get more harder as it goes along. But I'm not sure if that's just a myth or not.
Stefan, do you know anything further about what Dan's just said there?
Yeah. I believe the person
the big sigh.
with a lot of these things back in the day, it's a bit of a myth, and it could also be true. Often, a lot of great designs happen by mistake. I believe this one is true, as far as we know, but it's so far back. You can never be too sure.
Oh, I love it. There's always a bit of sort of urban legend in there, isn't there? When it Definitely. Comes to games and sort of what happened, what didn't happen, it's always always really interesting. Damien from Queensland, you've got a game that you used to play back in the 90s. What was that game? Hello, Damien. Nope, we don't have Damien. We have lost Damien. We will come back to Damien. But Peter from Queensland used to play a game. It was Minefield, but it was on, is it a Vectrex?
Yeah, Vectrex. It was a little black cube, basically, with a little TV screen in it and a fold-down control pad. It had four buttons and a joystick. And it was pretty advanced for its time because it was cartridge. And when you wanted the screen to change colour for the game, for different games, you actually put a piece of, like a plastic sleeve in front of the TV screen that was just a different coloured sleeve.
awesome. How long did you have that game for, Peter?
I've still got it.
Really?
I've still got it. I think I got it when I was about five, so that puts it to about, it must be 32 years old now and it still works.
Oh, wow. Stefan, do you have a Vectrex in your museum?
Yeah, we do, and we actually make it available for play. And as the caller said, it was really advanced for its time, and it's a fantastic machine. I think the only reason it didn't really take off was it came out in 1982, and there was a bit of a games crash in 1983, which is a bit of a shame because it was a fantastic machine.
So, Peter, is it still one of your favourites to play every now and then?
Look, I when I get really nostalgic, I like to just go down the local pub and find a pinball machine. I still love my pinnies.
Oh, okay. Have you got a favourite pinny then?
Favourite pinny would have to be Judge Dredd. The ultimate challenge on Judge Dredd went pretty crazy. But yeah, look, there was a lot of games on that Vectrex that were sort of front runners for games that came out on Atari. One called Scramble, which was a spaceship one, which I think was a more of a front runner for an arcade game called Moon Buggy, which was quite fun.
That was a good one.
Yeah, it was. And Spike, there was a game called Spike on it, which I think was a front runner for Donkey Kong. I think that's where they got the idea for Donkey Kong from, which was quite cool.
Peter, I love that you still have your Vectrex and keep on minefielding, won't you?
No drama.
Peter there from Queensland. Oh, with a game that used to use filters on the screen, Stefan. I've never seen a game where you put filters on your TV screen.
It was just a really clever decision by them in that you just put a little, you know, little sheet of plastic and, hey, suddenly your cheaper black and white TV or the screen that came with the box is suddenly colour. And I didn't know about that until maybe 2 or 3 weeks after I got the thing. And I sort of was poking at the screen. I was like, hang on, what is this? Yeah, it's black and white behind it.
Dan, have you ever seen one?
I haven't seen a Vectrex. I know a lot of the research. It's sort of a collector console, if such a thing exists. I mean, it's a bit of a train spotter console, which is I think really interesting with that overlay idea, and definitely ahead of its time in that respect. Yeah.
Dan, I didn't ask you what your first game experience was. What was your first electronic game?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that. I think it probably would be Super Mario on the Game Boy, the black and white Game Boy in, the very early 1990s sometime. Really classic sort of experience. I think I was travelling with my parents and they were extremely frustrated that I wouldn't look out the window at the, scenery and other side of the world, places that I was going. I was much more interested in the game in front of me, but hey.
It's always the way. Stephen in Victoria, you've got another Atari game to throw in tonight. What's that one?
Yes, I have from the early 80s to the late 80s to mid 80s was called Atlantis. Does anyone know about that?
I haven't seen Atlantis, Stefan.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, Stefan, have you heard about Atlantis, where that jet fighter used to come across the top of the screen with the line that used to destroy your land base?
I can't actually say I've seen that game.
And Dan, is that too before your time?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure about that one. I think he's
Stephen
outdone
is stumped.
Yeah.
Oh, tell us more about this game, Stephen.
It was absolutely fantastic. In each corner of the screen, on the left hand and right hand screen, you had an angle shoot, and in the middle you had a middle shoot, and then that had planes going across the top of the screen. But every so often they'd have a F-18, you'd call it, a jet fighter coming across with one complete line that would destroy your whole base.
Oh, how many levels did it have, Stephen?
Geez, it had a lot of levels. I never got to the top of the level. I tried. I never did, but it was such an enjoyable game.
Oh, Stephen, thank you so much for a bit of Atlantis on Atari, and one that we haven't actually, none of us know about that one, Stephen. Thank you so much. Talking electronic games here on ABC Local Radio, Stefan Antichik is the co-owner of Nostalgia Box in Perth in Western Australia. It's Australia's first video game console museum, and Dan Golding is a lecturer in media at Swinburne University. He's also the author of Game Changers, and he might have done a bit of radio looking at the history history of electronic games. Dan, in that radio series of yours, I mean, it's always hard to work out when you are doing a radio series what you put in and what you leave out of something like that, and the amount of research that goes into something like that. But when it comes to the music used in video games, did you get a chance to have a like just a touch on that?
Yeah, I wish we could have talked a little bit more about the music that's used in games. I mean, I've composed a soundtrack for a video game much more recently, but it really, yeah, like music in games is such a fascinating thing. And I was thinking before when you were playing that excerpt from the Scott Pilgrim soundtrack that actually here in Australia we have one of the computers that I believe was one of the first in the world to be used to make music in the 1950s, Cyrac, which now resides in the Melbourne Museum, which I'm sure would have been much more simple music than even we heard in the Scott Pilgrim style soundtrack. But yeah, the way that games use music is really fascinating, all the way from, you know, Space Invaders to Mario, definitely really iconic sort of sounds, all the way to today where, you know, we get stuff that's really, you know, sometimes indistinguishable from film Hollywood soundtracks.
Well, that's true. I think we've had a game soundtrack or a game theme song win a Grammy, I think, recently. So it's kind of getting up there in terms of acknowledgement, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That was, Austin Wintory, I think, possibly was nominated for that, for his work for Journey, which is an amazing, amazing soundtrack. And, I mean, even, you know, the symphony orchestras, I think Sydney Symphony Orchestra and Melbourne Symphony Orchestra have done concerts of video game music. It's not, you know, not that strange an idea to have one of, you know, these sort of elite cultural organisations performing music, you know, on the same stage that they do Beethoven and Mozart.
Peter, in the ACT, you've got a game from 1981 that's a favourite. What is it?
Oh, yeah, it was great. It wasn't my first game, but it's the best one I played back then. Yeah, it's called Asylum, and you had to escape from a mental asylum. And it was an adventure-type game with kind of basic graphics. And you really had to think outside the box to make any progress, and it was just brilliant. The bloke who designed it, just the things you had to think of.
Peter, is it one of those strategy games where, you know, when you do fail a level, you kind of start working out, okay, what you need to do to get past that? It's one of those,
to get past it, you've got to work out how to do it, yeah. So each time you fail, you go back to the start.
Oh, there was nothing worse, was there, Peter?
Oh, no, it was good. It's really... Yeah, really frustrating, and eventually, you know, when you work it out, it's kind of exhilarating.
Peter, thanks for the call. Peter in the ACT with Asylum from 1981. I've never played that one in particular. Stefan or Dan, have you? Does that one ring a bell for you?
No. I haven't played Asylum.
No.
Dan?
No, not for me, no. There were so many of those adventure games. They're classics, though. Absolutely fantastic.
Oh, definitely classics. Tristan in Western Australia, you're a PlayStation. Early PlayStation game is sort of your experience of games. What were those games that you first started with?
Yeah, I was born in mid-90s, so I grew up with when I started gaming, like in the early 2000s, started playing the PlayStation stuff. Dad got us one, and I just remember with the two other brothers, you know, every time you die on Crash Bandicoot or Spyro, you just pass the control over kind of thing. So, yeah, that's just really nostalgic for me, just hearing all these gaming things. Because, gaming's a big part of, not a big part, but it's one of my favourite hobbies. So, it's just good to hear the topic and share my experience with it.
Oh, thank you, Tristan. Dan, are you a Crash Bandicoot fan?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was very much one of those... similar experiences of like going around to a friend's place and being introduced to this game. And it was that and Sonic the Hedgehog as well, where I remember it was, you know, passing the controller. I mean, those are on different consoles, but definitely, you know, like when you would fail a level, you'd pass it to the next person. And, you know, that real sort of social experience that you had as a kid with those even single player games, it was, really interesting how that worked.
Oh, my brother and sister used to annoy me with Sonic the Hedgehog, and I was bad at it. Like, it was not in my realm of just...
It's pretty hard.
I had to hand it either to my smaller brother, like my little brother or my little sister, to get me through to the next level. which is quite sad. I've worked out that I'm better at games like Space Invaders and those sorts of things where you're just shooting and trying to stay alive pretty much. George in New South Wales, Space Invaders, that's one of the ones that you love.
Yes, absolutely.
What was it about Space Invaders?
So basically it was the music as your guys are sort of like...
That Dan was talking about?
Yeah. They sort of like put in the feel, the vibration, this, that and the other, the ambience, whatever. And I always thought, well, why can't we have this at home? So, like, in 1975, I actually rang up Atari and spoke to the lady there, and she goes, yeah, how are you? How are you going? And I said, well, can we get this on the TV, you know, in home, instead of having to put, at the time, 20 cents into the machines and this, that, and the other. And she said, just one moment, please. And she put me on to the head design engineer, and we went through... And I was 7 at the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So from that point on, I worked in the industry for Bally, Tato, SNK, Sega, some big places in their board design, fabrication, this, that, and the other. So all of the things that you're talking about, the video games themselves, are absolutely what I know. And the source code and everything. Code back in the day. So, yeah, it's awesome. But the first game I ever played was a five-year-old at UTS opposite the ABC building. It used to be the Science Museum, I think, there. And they actually had tic-tac-toe. And you actually had a window and you could play noughts and crosses. And my mum put me up there, and that's the first time, and it was a Perspex box that you could actually see the componentry, this, that, and the other, and play a computer. You couldn't touch it, but you could go through the window.
And that's what got you hooked, George.
Absolutely. Doing it to this day.
Well, yeah. Well, what are you playing these days, George? What, do you have a favourite from sort of now?
Oh, okay. Yeah, to shoot 'em up, it would have to be Halo series.
Yeah, Dan, are you a Halo player?
Yeah, it's hugely popular. Halo is, and I've spent far too many hours in that game, definitely. Yeah.
George in New South Wales, thank you for calling in. Oh, Space Invaders got to do it all. Stefan, how good would that job have been back in the day? Do you wish that you were doing that, doing what George was doing all those years ago, go back in a time machine?
Definitely. I mean, you're essentially at the forefront of something that's become such a huge part of our lives. I mean, maybe they didn't realize it back then, but just, you know, being a key person that can influence it in very early industry during, you know, its birth and its growth, it will be a fantastic job.
Tonight we've been taking a look at the history of electronic games with Dan Golding from Swinburne University and Stefan Antichik, the co-owner of the Nostalgia Box in Perth in Western Australia. Stefan, Dan mentioned before about this kind of, not the plane spotter, but the game spotter and those sort of, you know, the collector's collector editions of games. What are some of those games that, you know, if you are an avid collector, it's the one that you're on the lookout for?
It sort of depends what generation you're looking at. I mean, Vectrex is one, the original Magnavox Odyssey. A bit more recent would be the Dreamcast, which was a commercial failure, but it was such a fantastic machine that people that do own it will not get rid of it, whatever you try. And then I guess the most famous one is, ironically, because it was a huge failure, was E.T., the game, which was just, it's rated as one of the worst games ever made.
And Atari paid a lot of money to get the license for that, for E.T., didn't it?
It did, yeah. It was just a cash-in, basically, before the movie came out or shortly afterwards.
Are you one of those people, Stefan, that if you could have an E.T. cartridge, you would?
Oh, yeah, Definitely. That's not even a question.
It's funny you should mention that, Stefan, because after the news, we're actually going to be talking to someone who was the archaeologist on the E.T. Atari excavation mission. And he talks a bit about what it was like to dig for those cartridges, not knowing if they were going to find anything or not. So it's funny that you should mention that. Dan, I mean, with what you've got sort of on the cards at the moment, and, you know, is gaming one of those things that you think that you'll be doing probably for the rest of your life and maybe in an academic situation as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I mean, I think nothing says that more to me than actually the song that you played before. I mean, yeah, as you said, it was adapted from a Russian folk song, but, you know, I don't think it matters to most people today that that's the case. It's just, it's become another kind of folk song for, you know, the way that games are now just a part of everyday life for, I think, a huge majority of people. And so I think, you know, going into the future, that's only just going to be continuing to grow and be more the case. They're just part of what we do, I guess, for entertainment and part of our lives. So yeah, definitely, 100%.
Dan and Stefan, thank you so much for coming on and talking a little bit about the history of games tonight, and keep gaming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Dan Golding. He's a lecturer at Swinburne University, and also Stefan Antichik, who is the co-owner of the Nostalgia Box in Perth in Western Australia, which is Australia's first video game console museum, but also a place where if you're into games like this, you can go and play some of those games from the past.